Rick. This fella Trump is bad news. He's worse than Major Strasser.
Act occasionally. Why don't you make a donation?
I already did. At give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org.
Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
There is nothing wrong with your radio. Do not attempt to switch the station. You are locked into our frequency at 99.5 on your FM dial. If we wish to make it louder, we can turn up the volume. If we wish to make it softer, we can tune it to a whisper. We can take the music and change it to fit all that we want you to hear throughout the course of this broadcast. We can take the music and change it from vintage psychedelia to soft, mystical reggae. We can transform a 60s classic and propel the song right into modern times. Come down off your throne. For the remainder of the program, sit quietly and we will control all that you hear. You will experience the awe and mystery that takes you from the depth of night and covers your entire body with morning dew. WBAI, New York.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This is a recorded program. Our guest will be S.A. Chakraborty. Stay tuned. And once again, good morning. So this is one of those rare occasions in which I have pre-produced this program. In fact, today it is Wednesday, so it's only broadcast, about 9 hours after I'm speaking these very words. But it makes things a lot easier, especially on what comes out to being a holiday morning. And because our guest, S.A. Chakraborty, was not able to make it to tonight to the station, we pre-recorded our interview by Skype last Monday. Now, I hate doing what they call phoners, and I guess that would now be Skypers, but the sound quality is better than it has been in recent times. And also, this isn't an author I haven't met. That's a rule. I'm not going to interview you remotely unless we have met somehow. And even then, I'm not as good at what I do when doing it in that manner. So, there. So, let's see. This all came as a result of... So, Shan read for us 2 weeks ago, along with the amazing and wonderful Chris Dykeman, who is one of the great artists. She did the logo, that is the Hour of the Wolf logo, as a matter of fact. But first, let's tell you a little bit more about the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, because we have one coming up ere long on December 5th. And that's usually our family special, our family being Delia Sherman and Ellen Kushner, but they are in Paris. So they're spending quite some time there, and I hope having a wonderful time. So we're going to have a festive event instead. And Sarah Pinsker is going to perform music, and Kat Valenti is bringing in a game show. Let me tell you about these folk. Sarah Pinsker is the author of the Nebula Award-winning novelette, Our Lady of the Open Road, and the Theodore Sturgeon Award-winning novelette, Enjoy Knowing the Abyss Behind. Her stories have appeared in Asimov's, Strange Horizons, Fantasy and Science Fiction, Lightspeed, and Uncanny, among others, and in anthologies including Long Hidden and New Voices of Fantasy. She is also a singer-songwriter and toured nationally behind 3 albums on various independent labels. A fourth is forthcoming. She lives with her wife and dog in Baltimore, Maryland. Find her online at sarahpinsker.com and on Twitter at SARAHPINSKER. And then the second half of the show, Catherine M. Valenti, the New York Times bestselling author of over 24 works of fiction and poetry, including Palimpsest, The Orphan's Tale series, Deathless, Radiance, and the crowdfunded phenomenon The Girl Who Circumnavigated Fairyland in a Ship of Her Own Making, and the 4 books that followed it. She is the winner of the Andre Norton Tiptree Sturgeon Pre-Imaginal Yugi Foster Memorial Mythopoeic Riesling Lambda Locus Romantic Times Critic Choice and Hugo Awards. She has been a finalist for the Nebula and World Fantasy Awards. She lives on an island off the coast of Maine with a small but growing menagerie of beasts, some of which are human. And Sarah will be singing, and Kat will be presenting a quiz show, which is incredible fun. I saw her do this at ReaderCon. And her partner Heath and Sarah will be 2 of the contestants, and we'll find out who the others are. So that's December 5th, 7 p.m. at 388 Atlantic Avenue. Admission is free, and we will look at you dolefully. Dolefully, in order to try to get contributions to keep the reading series going. So, speaking of those reading series, we were very, very pleased. Well, I'll talk about it during the interview, but much earlier this year, I met Shannon Chakraborty as Cam Roberson put together an incredible evening of different writers. I was not familiar with them, except for Harris Durrani, who I have to have live on the show sometime. And I thought that Shan was incredible. And her novel has now come out. I've been pressing, when are you going to do my show? And she said, when my novel comes out. Well, her novel came out last week, and at the time of the reading would be coming out in 1 week. So you can figure out that it came out on, November 14th. S.A. Chakraborty is a fantasy writer from New York City. Her debut, The City of Brass, is the first book. You know what? I don't have to do all of this, because Amy Goldschlager, who substituted for me 2 weeks ago, I had thrown out my back, does the introduction herself. So, hey, let's just set your Wayback Machine for a couple of weeks ago, and let's enjoy Shan's reading.
Okay, I think we are going to get started again. Now we have our second reader, who I'm going to introduce. She can still be in a lovely picture that Melissa's taking. All right. It's okay. You're doing your business. You know, and I actually did not thank Melissa Beckman, who is our official photographer for this series. She always does a beautiful job. Of course, I say that because I use one of her shots as a headshot, but that is just me. Anyway, S.A. Chakraborty is a fantasy writer from New York. Her debut, The City of Brass, is the first book in the Devabad trilogy, an epic fantasy set in the 18th century Middle East that will be published in November 2017. I think it's just days away. I'm very excited about it personally, by Harper Voyager. When not buried in books about Mughal portraiture and Omani history, S.A. enjoys hiking, knitting, and cooking unnecessarily complicated meals for her family. You can find her online at sachakraborty.com or on Twitter at @schakrabs, where she likes to ramble about history, politics, and Islamic art. Shannon is a proud member of the Brooklyn Speculative Fiction Writers Group, which really is a great group. So, you know.
Thank you for introducing me, and thank you all for coming out on this absolutely terrible night. So, I appreciate that. I am actually going to start from the beginning of my novel, and since it was just introduced, I don't really need to talk about it. And I'm going to apologize if my voice sounds a little off. I'm getting over a cold. But, okay. He was an easy mark. Nahri smiled behind her veil, watching the two men bicker as they approached her stall. The younger one glanced anxiously down the alley, while the older man, her client, sweated in the cool dawn air. Save for the men, the alley was empty. Fajr had already been called, and anyone devout enough for public prayer, not that there were many in her neighborhood, was already ensconced in a small mosque at the end of the street. She fought a yawn. Nahri was not one for dawn prayer, but her client had chosen the early hour and paid handsomely for discretion. She studied the men as they approached, noting their light features and the cut of their expensive coats. Turks, she suspected. The eldest might even be a basha, one of the few who hadn't fled Cairo when the Franks invaded. She crossed her arms over her black abaya, growing intrigued. Nahri didn't have many Turkish clients. They were too snobbish. Indeed, when the Franks and Turks weren't fighting over Egypt, the only thing they seemed to agree on was that the Egyptians couldn't govern it themselves. God forbid. It's not as though the Egyptians were the inheritors of a great civilization whose mighty monuments still littered the land. Oh no, they were peasants, superstitious fools who ate too many beans. Well, this superstitious fool is about to swindle you for all that you're worth, so insult away. Nahri smiled wider as the men approached. She greeted them warmly and ushered them into her tiny stall, serving the elder a bitter tea made from crushed fenugreek seeds and coarsely chopped mint. He drank it quickly, but Nahri took her time reading the leaves, murmuring and singing in her native tongue, a language the men most certainly wouldn't know, a language not even she had a name for. The longer she took, the more desperate he would be, the more gullible. Her stall was hot, with the air trapped by the dark scarves she hung on the walls to protect her client's privacy, and thick with the odors of burnt cedar, sweat, and the cheap yellow wax she passed off as frankincense. Her client nervously kneaded the hem of his coat, perspiration pouring down his ruddy face and dampening the embroidered collar. The younger man scowled. "This is foolish, brother," he whispered in Turkish. "The doctor said there's nothing wrong with you." Nahri hid a triumphant smile. So they were Turks. They wouldn't expect her to understand them. They probably assumed an Egyptian street healer barely spoke proper Arabic. But Nahri knew Turkish as well as she knew her native tongue. In Arabic and Hebrew, scholarly Persian, high-class Venetian, and coastal Swahili. In her 20 or so years of life, she had yet to come upon a language she didn't immediately understand. But the Turks didn't need to know that, so she ignored them, pretending to study the dregs in the Basha's cup. Finally, she sighed, the gauzy veil fluttering against her lips in a way that drew the gazes of both men, and dropped the cup to the floor. It broke, as it was meant to, and the Basha gasped. "By the Almighty, it's bad, isn't it?" Nahri glanced up at the man, languidly blinking long-lashed black eyes. He'd gone pale. She paused to listen for the pulse of his heart. It was fast and uneven due to fright, but she could sense it pumping healthy blood throughout his body. His breath was clean of sickness, and there was an unmistakable brightness in his dark eyes. Despite the graying hairs in his beard, ill-hidden by henna, and the plumpness in his belly, he suffered from nothing other than an excess of wealth. She would be very glad to help him with that. "I am so sorry, sir." Nahri pushed back the small cloth sack, her quick fingers estimating the number of dirhams it held. "Please take back your money." The Basha's eyes popped. "What? Why?" She dropped her gaze. "There are some things that are even beyond me." "God, do you hear her, Arslan?" The Basha turned to his brother, tears in his eyes. "You said I was crazy," he accused, choking back a sob. "Now I'm going to die." He buried his head in his hands and wept, while Nahri counted the gold rings on his fingers. "I was so looking forward to marrying." Arslan shot her an irritated look before turning back to the Basha. "Pull yourself together, Kamal," he hissed in Turkish. The Basha wiped his eyes and looked up at her. "No. There must be something you can do. I've heard rumors about you. People say you made a paralyzed boy walk by just looking at him. You must be able to help me." Nahri leaned back, hiding her pleasure. She had no idea what boy he was referring to. God be praised, certainly helped her reputation. She touched her heart. "Oh, sir, it grieves me so to deliver such news. And to think of your dear bride being deprived of such a prize." The Basha's shoulders shook as he sobbed. She waited for him to grow a bit more hysterical, taking the opportunity to appraise the thick gold band circling his wrist and neck. A fine garnet, beautifully cut, was pinned to his turban. Finally, she spoke again. "There might be something, but..." She shook her head. "It wouldn't work." "What?" He clutched the narrow table. "Please, I'll do anything." "It will be very difficult." Arslan sighed. "And expensive, I bet." Nahri hid her irritation. "Oh, so now he speaks Arabic." She gave him a sweet smile, knowing her veil was gauzy enough to reveal her features. "All of my prices are fair, I assure you." "Be silent, brother," the Basha snapped, glowering at the other man. He looked at Nahri, his face set. "Tell me." It's not a certainty, she cautioned. I must try. You are a brave man, she said, letting her voice tremble. Indeed, I believe your affliction has come about from an evil eye. Someone is envious of you, sir, and who wouldn't be? Man of your wealth and your beauty could only attract envy. It might even be someone close. Her glance at Arslan was brief, but enough to make his cheeks redden. You must clear your house of any darkness that the evil eye has brought in. How? The Basha asked, his voice hushed and eager. First, you must promise to follow my instructions exactly. Of course. She leaned forward, intent. Obtain a mixture of one part ambergris to two parts cedar oil, a good amount. Get them from Yaqub down the alley. He has the best stuff. Yaqub? The Basha repeated. Yes. Ask for some powdered lime rind and walnut oil as well. Arslan was watching his brother with open disbelief, but hope brightened in the Basha's eyes. And then? This is where it might get difficult, but sir, Nahri touched his hand and he shuddered. You will only make things worse if you don't follow my steps exactly. I will, I swear, he promised. Your house needs to be cleansed, and that can only be done if it's abandoned. Your entire family must leave. Animals, servants, all. There must not be a living soul in the house for 7 days. 7 days? He lowered his voice at the disapproval in her eyes. Well, where are we to go? The oasis at Fayum, Nahri answered. Arslan laughed, but she continued. Go to the second smallest spring at sunset. Gather some water in a basket made of local reeds, say the throne verse over it 3 times, and then use it for your ablutions. Mark your doors with the ambergris and oil before you leave, and by the time you return, God willing, the envy will be gone. Fayum, Arslan interrupted. God, girl, even you must know there's a war on. Is he supposed to be picking up baskets for Napoleon on the way? Be quiet. The Basha banged on the table before turning back to Nahri. But such thing will be difficult. She spread her hands. That's why God provides. Yes, of course. You're right. So it will be Fayum, the Basha decided, looking determined. And then my heart will be cured? She paused. It was the heart he was worried about? Go willing, sir. Have your new wife put the powdered lime and oil into your evening tea for the next month. It wouldn't do anything for his non-existent heart problem, but his bride might enjoy his breath. She let go of his hand. The Basha blinked as if released from a spell. Thank you, dear one, thank you. He pushed back the small sack of coins and then slipped a heavy gold ring from his pinky and handed that over as well. God bless you. Nahri bowed her head. May your marriage be fruitful. He rose heavily to his feet. I must ask, child, where are your people from? You've a Kyrene accent, but there's something about your eyes. Nahri pressed her lips together. She hated when people asked after her heritage. Though she wasn't what many would call beautiful, years of living on the streets had left her far thinner and much dirtier than men typically preferred. Her bright eyes and sharp face usually spurred a second glance. And it was that second glance, the one that revealed a line of midnight hair and uncommonly black eyes, unnaturally black eyes, she'd heard it said, that provoked questions. I'm as Egyptian as the Nile, she assured. He smiled at that and touched his brow. In peace, then. He ducked under the doorway to leave. Arslan stayed behind another moment. Nahri could feel his eyes as she gathered her payment. You do realize you just committed a crime, yes? He asked, his voice sharp. I'm sorry? He stepped closer. A crime, you fool! Witchcraft is a crime under Ottoman law. Nahri couldn't help herself. Arslan was only the latest in a long line of puffed-up Turkish officials she'd had to deal with growing up in Cairo under Ottoman rule. Well, then I suppose I'm lucky the Franks are in charge now. It was a mistake. His face instantly reddened. He raised his hand and Nahri flinched, her fingers reflexively tightening over the Basha's ring. One sharp edge cut into her palm. But he didn't hit her. Instead, he spat at her feet. God is my witness, you thieving witch. When we clear the French out of Egypt, filth like you will be the next to go. He shot her another hate-filled glare and then left. She took a shaky breath as she watched the arguing brothers disappear into the early morning gloom towards Jacob's apothecary. But it wasn't the threat that unsettled her. It was the rattle she'd heard when he'd shouted, the smell of iron-rich blood in the air. A diseased lung, consumption, maybe even a cancerous mass. There was no outward sign of it yet, but soon. Arslan had been right to suspect her. There was nothing wrong with his brother. But he wouldn't live to see his people reconquer her country. She unclenched her fist. The gash in her palm was already healing, a line of new brown skin knitting together beneath the blood. She stared at it for a long moment and then sighed before ducking back inside her stall. She pulled off a knotted headdress and crumpled it into a ball. You fool, you know better than to lose your temper with men like that. Nahri didn't need any more enemies, especially ones now likely to post guards around the Basha's house while he was in Fayum. What he paid today was a pittance compared to what she could steal from his empty villa. She wouldn't have taken much. She'd been doing her tricks long enough to avoid temptations of excess. But some jewelry that could be blamed on a forgetful wife, a quick-fingered servant, baubles that would have meant nothing to the Basha and a month's rent to her, those Nahri would take. Muttering another curse, she rolled back her sleeping mat and dislodged a few bricks from the floor. She dropped the Basha's coins and ring into the shallow hole, frowning at her meager savings. It's not enough. It's never going to be enough. She replaced the bricks, calculating how much she still needed to pay for this month's rents and bribes, the inflated costs of her increasingly unsavory profession. The number always grew, pushing away her dreams of Istanbul and tutors, of a respectable trade and actual healing instead of this magical nonsense. But there was nothing to be done about it now, and Nahri wasn't about to take time from earning money to bemoan her fate. She stood, winding a rumpled headscarf around her messy curls and gathering up the amulets she'd made for the Barzani women and the poultice for the butcher. She'd need to come back later to prepare for the Tsar, but for now, she had someone far more important to see. Jakub's apothecary was located at the end of the alley, crammed between a moldering fruit stand and a bread bakery. No one knew what had led the elderly Jewish pharmacist to open an apothecary in such a grim slum. Most of the people living in her neighborhood were desperate, prostitutes and addicts. Jakub had moved in quietly several years ago, settling his family into the upper floors of the cleanest building. The neighbors had wagged their tongues, spreading rumors of gambling debts and drunkenness, or darker charges that his son had killed a Muslim, that Jakub himself took blood and humors from the alley's half-dead addicts. Nahri thought it all nonsense, but she didn't dare ask. She didn't question his background, and he didn't ask why a former pickpocket could diagnose illnesses better than the Sultan's personal physician. Their strange partnership rested on avoiding those two subjects. She entered the apothecary, quickly sidestepping the battered bell meant to announce customers. Crowded with supplies and impossibly chaotic, Jakub's shop was her favorite place in the world. Mismatched wooden shelves crammed with dusty glass vials, tiny reed baskets, and crumbling ceramic jars covered the walls. Lengths of dried herbs, animal parts, and objects she couldn't identify hung from the ceiling while clay and fori competed for the small amount of floor space. Jakub knew his inventory like the lines of his palm, and listening to his stories of ancient magi or the hot spice lands of the Hin transported her to worlds she could hardly imagine. He was bent over his workbench, mixing something that gave off a sharp, unpleasant scent. She smiled at the sight of the old man with his even older instruments. His mortar alone looked like something from the reign of Salah ad-Din. "Sabah al-Khair," she greeted. Yaqub made a startled noise and glanced up, knocking his forehead into a hanging garlic braid. Swatting it away, he grumbled, "Sabah al-Nur, can't you make some noise when you enter? You scared me half to death." Nahri grinned. "I like to surprise you." He snorted. "Sneak up on me, you mean. You get more like the devil each day." She pushed up on her hands to perch on his work table. "That's a very unkind thing to say to someone who brought you a small fortune this morning." "Fortune? Is that what you call two bickering Ottoman officials banging down my door at dawn? My wife nearly had a heart attack. So buy her some jewelry with the money." Yaqub shook his head. "An ambergris. You're lucky I even had some in stock. What, could you not convince him to paint his door in molten gold this time?" She shrugged, picking up one of the jars near his elbow and taking a delicate sniff. They looked like they could afford it. "Well, the younger one had quite an earful to say about you." "Can't please everyone." She picked up another jar, watching as he added some candlenut kernels to his mortar. He put the pestle down with a sigh, holding his handle out for the jar, which she reluctantly handed back. "What are you making?" she asked. "This?" He returned to grinding the kernels. "A poultice for the cobbler's wife. She's been dizzy." Nahri watched another moment. "That's not going to help." "Oh, really? Tell me again, doctor. Who did you train under?" Nahri smiled. Yaqub hated when she did this. She turned back to the shelves, hunting for the familiar pot. The shop was a chaos, a mess of unlabeled jars and supplies that seemed to get up and move on their own. "She's pregnant," she called over her shoulder. She picked up a vial of peppermint oil, swatting away a spider that crawled over the top. "Pregnant?" Her husband said nothing. Nahri pushed the vial in his direction and added a gnarled root of ginger. "It's early. They probably don't know yet." He gave her a sharp look. "How do you know?" "Because she vomits loudly enough to wake Shaitan. May he be cursed." Nahri smiled, trying to reassure him. "Make her a tea from this." "I haven't heard her." "Grandfather, you don't hear me come in either," Nahri pointed out. "See, the fault lies with your ears." Yaqub pushed away the mortar with a disgruntled noise and turned to the back corner where he kept his earnings. "Wish you'd stop playing Musa ben Maimon and find yourself a husband." He pulled out his trunk. The hinges groaned as he opened the battered top. Nahri laughed. "If you could find someone willing to marry the likes of me, you would put every matchmaker in Cairo out of business." She pawed through the random assortment of books, receipts, and vials on the table, searching for the small enameled case where Yaqub kept sesame candies for his grandchildren, finally finding it beneath a dusty ledger. "Besides," she continued, plucking out two of the candies, "I like our partnership." He handed her a small sack. Nahri could tell from its weight that it was more than her usual cut. She started to protest, but he cut her off. "Stay away from men like that, Nahri. It's dangerous." "Why? The Franks are in charge now." She chewed her candy, suddenly curious. "Is it really true that Frankish women go about naked in the street?" The pharmacist shook his head, used to her impropriety. "French, child, not Frankish. God prevent you from hearing that wickedness. Abu Taha says their leader has the feet of a goat." "Abu Taha should stick to mending shoes, but don't change the subject," he said. "I'm trying to warn you." "Warn me? Why? I've never even talked to a Frank." That wasn't for lack of effort. Nahri had tried selling amulets to the few French soldiers she encountered, and they backed away like she was some sort of snake, making condescending remarks in their strange language about her clothing. He locked eyes with her. "You're young," he said quietly. "You have no experience with what happens to people like us during war, people who are different. You should keep your head down, or better yet, leave. Whatever happened to your grand plans of Istanbul? After counting her savings this morning, the mere mention of the city soured her. "Thought you said I was being foolish," she reminded him, "that no physician would take on a female apprentice." "You could be a midwife," he offered. "You've delivered babies before. You could go east, away from this war." "You sound eager to be rid of me." He touched her hand, his brown eyes filled with concern. "I'm eager to see you safe. You have no family, no husband, nobody to stand up for you, to protect you." Nahri bristled. "I can take care of myself." "To advise you against doing dangerous things." He gave her a look. "Things like leading czars." "Ah." Nahri winced. "I had hoped you wouldn't hear about those." "Then you're a fool. You shouldn't be getting caught up in that southern magic." He gestured behind her. "Get me a tin." She fetched one for him from the shelf, tossing it with a bit more force than was necessary. "There's no magic," she dismissed. "It's harmless." "Harmless?" Yakub scoffed as he shoveled tin into the tea. "I've heard rumors about those czars. Blood sacrifices, trying to exorcise jinn." "It's not really meant to exorcise them," Nahri corrected lightly. "It's more like an effort to make peace." Yakub stared at her. "You shouldn't be trying to do anything with jinn." He shook his head, closing the tin and rubbing warm wax over the seams. "You're playing with things you don't understand, Nahri. They're not your traditions. You're going to get your soul snapped up by a demon if you're not more careful." Nahri was oddly touched by his concern. To think just a few years ago, he dismissed her as a black-hearted fraudster. "Grandfather," she started, trying to sound more respectful. "You needn't worry. There's no magic, I swear." Seeing the doubt on his face, she decided to be more frank. "It's nonsense, all of it. There's no magic, no jinn, no spirits waiting to eat us up. I've been doing my tricks long enough to learn none of it's real." He paused. "There are things I've seen you do that don't make sense." "Maybe I'm just a better trickster than the rest," she replied quickly, trying to erase the brief fear she saw in his face. Nahri didn't need to scare off her only friend simply because she had a few strange skills. Yakub shook his head. "There are still jinn and demons. Scholars say so." "Well, the scholars are wrong. No spirit has come after me yet." "It's very arrogant, Nahri. Blasphemous, even. Only a fool would speak in such a way." She lifted her chin defiantly. "They don't exist." He sighed. "No one can say I didn't try." He pushed the tin over. "Give that to the cobbler on your way out, will you?" Nahri pushed off the table. "Are you doing inventory tomorrow?" Arrogant she might be, she rarely passed on an opportunity to learn more about the apothecary. Yakub's knowledge had greatly advanced her own instincts for healing. "Yes, but come early. We have a lot to get through." She nodded. "God willing." "Go buy some kebab," he said, nodding at the purse. "You're all bones. The jinn will want more to eat, should they come for you."
Thank you. golden share, is massive and abstract. In everywhere travels on his wrath, from the east to the west, he's known as majestic Ganesh. Adored by the Hindus, may seem rather odd. He'll dance away your blues when you need to be blessed. Call on majestic Ganesh. Majestic Ganesh. Majestic Ganesh.
And you're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City. WBAI at 99.5 FM. This program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and this is a program pre-recorded for the morning of November 15th, 2017. And you just heard Majestic Ganesh from the band Tribekistan from their album Goddess Polka Dotis. Got that? Okay. So, on Monday, 2 days ago, 3 days ago, depending on, well, which side of midnight you are, Shan and I conducted an interview running a little over an hour via Skype. Here it is.
Let's start.
Okay, fine. So, I am on Skype to Skype, something I very rarely do, with S.A. Chakraborty, a.k.a. Shannon or Shan, which would not be, I think, most people's first guess when they, see the name Chakraborty.
No, my married name.
Yes. May I ask your, I don't like the term maiden name, your original name?
I don't tell people my original name because it is a terrible Ellis Island mistake that sounds like a part of the human anatomy, and I can't tell you how happy I was to change it when I got married.
Okay, that's a good thing. Yeah, but how many generations ago did they foist that last name on your family?
Just two.
Okay.
Yeah, just two. And my brother laughs because he's stuck with it. But I was just like, oh no, I'm changing it.
Yeah, no, I'm first generation American myself. So uh-huh. my mother was changed from Liesel to Elizabeth, and my uncle from Wolfgang to George.
Yeah, they tended to do that.
Yes, and especially because it's World War, just pre World War II, and you didn't want too many Wolfgangs hanging around. So
yeah. No, even my great-grandparents are from Ireland and Italy, but my Italian side came over here and started going by different names as well right before World War II.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of thing, sadly, still has to go on, but now it's not, at least it's not Ellis Island mistakes anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah. Your first novel, this is a thrill. I've known you now for, I guess, just about a year.
Yeah, this time last year I did my first real reading for you.
Yeah, that's right. And that was at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which is separate from Hour of the Wolf and WBAI. The NYRSF readings are a series that I took over and now have been running for 15 years. But Gordon Van Gelder started it like 27 years ago, and I've been recording them for all those years.
Oh, wow.
And but Cam, two people, Cam Roberson and Rob Cameron, together put together one of the readings. The twin brothers, but you never see one. When the other one's around, it's very mysterious. Clark Kent Superman kind of
course.
A thing going
he would,
on.
I'm there. Sure he would be thrilled to hear you just called him Clark Kent Superman.
He probably would be, yes. I can see him right now with that happy face of his.
Yes.
he put together a fabulous evening, which is available online, by the way. People can watch it. By going to live stream and searching on NYRSF, on NYRSF, and you will see both Shan's reading from 2 weeks ago and from a year ago. And the one 2 weeks ago, in 26-plus years of recording those readings and or producing them, it's only the second one I ever missed.
Oh, that's so sad.
It really is. I had thrown my back out in classic, you're over 60 years old now, so you get to get your back thrown out, kind of, I didn't deserve this thing. And fortunately, we have such a great support staff that Barbara Krasnoff ran the door, and Madeline Flieger did the tech support without our main tech operator, Terrence Taylor, being there. And you had help from people who've helped us. They had help from people who've helped us in the past, namely Sam Schreiber. So it all came out very well, and people can go and watch the event. Now, but what's more thrilling about this event is than the previous one is your novel, The City of Brass. And again, for people, let's give the proper byline, S.A.
Yes.
Chakraborty, which is exactly, it's actually very easy to spell, if you listen to it, it's a C-H-A-K-R-A-B-O-R-T-Y.
It is. I think it intimidates some people, but it's actually quite phonetic.
Yeah, it's very phonetic. It's just, you know, is it a hard C or a soft C? If somebody hears it, they might say, is that a C or an S?
Well, you know what? You'd have to check with my in-laws, because now my husband always says Chakraborty, so I say Chakraborty, but in... You know, his family speaks Bengali, and sometimes it's more of a softer sound, like Chakraborty.
Okay, so
that... Or sometimes you see it spelled with a V, so I just do what they do.
With a V?
Yes.
Wow, okay.
The V instead of a B.
Oh, the B. Okay, so got it, Chakraborty. Okay. Well, that actually sounds very genuine. I guess it's just a regional difference.
It might be.
Yeah, could be. But at any rate, it's... a simple enough name once somebody looks at it and mouths it, and then it's like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, sure. very simple. I know people are intimidated by long names, but I find them wonderful. Just there was a fellow at WBAI in the 70s named Maliki Aluwambe. And how can you forget a name like that? It's a wonderful musical sound and easy, and when you think about it, easy to spell.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, but why the S-A as opposed to Shannon or Shan?
I mean, my full name is Shannon. I decided to use my initials when I first signed because I had a little bit of a crazy signing story, which is that I wrote this book and it was my first book and I didn't really think much was going to happen with it, but I got an agent and she was very enthusiastic and we ended up going to auction in 2 weeks. Which was very exciting and thrilling, but also very, very frightening. And I had some ongoing issues with privacy that I won't really get into on the air, but and that I've kind of taken care of in the past month, fortunately. But I decided to use my initials just because I was like, I don't know that I'm ready to be the only Shannon Chakraborty in the entire world and so easily identified. And now it's funny because now it's, you know, but at the same time, whenever I introduce myself to people, it feels strange to call myself my initial. So I've kind of gone back to Shannon, and then, you know, on the book cover, I have SA, and it just is what it is now at this point.
Yeah, and it's fine.
Yeah.
For me, it's a throwback, a political throwback to the days when Ursula Le Guin was in Playboy magazine as UK Le Guin.
Mm-hmm.
When women who were writing something that might just be interpreted as the kind of fiction that men write were given two initials at the beginning.
And a lot of people still do that. Now, you know, I'm not sure. I talk to some people and some people say it's for that reason and some people it's just a preference, you know, how it's written.
Yeah, yeah. But historically.
Yeah, historically that was why.
Yeah, historically it was to hide gender. And or unless the person had a name that could go either way, like Lee Brackett.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was, you know, quite realized necessarily that the author of The Big Sleep, or for that matter, The Empire Strikes Back, was a woman.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. One of the great science fiction writers and screenwriters mm-hmm. of all time. And yes, she wrote The Big Sleep for Howard Hawks. William Faulkner gets top billing, but there is a legend that, basically He was there. He woke up every so often. And she'd say, how does this look, Bill? And he'd go, and, you know. So she and Jules Furthman wrote, the classic Bogart Bacall movie. And she's written a lot of science fantasy, great stuff, right through the pulp era. And she wrote The Empire Strikes Back and died just before the last draft, well into her 80s. She wasn't a kid. And and Lawrence Kasdan took it over. But she wrote for Robert Altman and John Ford and all. You know, she was...
Lee Brackett? I want to look her up now.
Yeah, L-E-I-G-H Brackett. Yeah, B-R-A-C-K-E-T-T. Definitely look her up. Definitely read... her stuff is like a pulp version, in a way, of what The City of Brass might be.
Oh, really? No, I'm intrigued.
Yeah. Imagine a somewhat more mature in tone sense of adventure than Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Okay. Interesting.
And, so The Sorceress of Venus and titles like that.
Hmm. So, check that out. It's been a very long time since I read stuff like that, so curious to see.
Yeah, and it's a throwback, but it's so wonderful because it's like, you just gobble it up, and you don't worry about the subtext, the meaning, or anything like that. But I have to say, The City of Brass is a romp in a way. It's both it's both genuine, but at the same time, it's just too much fun.
Well, thank you. I was actually trying for that. I mean, I pulled from a lot of the old folklore stories, and I know people know 1001 Nights, but there's a lot more besides that, and so many of them have what is essentially their pulp. I mean, they were told to be pulp. They were told to be these big, adventure tales that it's, you go on and it's great because the author or the narrator, or certain points, it'll just trail off and it'd be like, we're not giving any more details on this because it tires the tongue. And, people go from fighting statues to rescuing the beautiful princess. And, there's very little, complicated plot development, but they're fun. That's exactly what I was trying to capture some of that with my book.
Yeah, I think you got that for sure. It's why Lee Brackett's name came to mind also, as far as I'm concerned, that's a great yardstick.
Yeah.
She was incredibly successful and, had every right to be. I mean, just if she did nothing but The Empire Strikes Back.
But now you said she died right before it came out?
Yes, she died.
Oh, that's awful.
She died just as she was working on the final draft. And the legend is that she was the one who said, okay, we're going to have three trilogies.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore Lucas changed a movie that was just called Star Wars to Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope. And she wrote Episode 5, and she had a plot basis for Episode 6, which they only slightly followed. But she had conceived, which is totally out the window now, 1, 2, 3, and 7, 8, 9, which were totally discarded.
Do people know what they were, though?
No.
Oh, really?
No. I won't say it died with her. It is believed that Lucas had the vaguest idea, because of course he would have discussed it with her, and possibly Lawrence Kasdan, because he was working with her when it was realized that she didn't have much time left, and he's the one who polished and finished off The Empire Strikes Back.
That's really interesting, just because Empire Strikes Back is such a great movie. I wonder what she thought of for the earlier ones as well.
Well, we know that she was a big fan of Star Wars, and a lot of Star Wars. And when I say Star Wars, I'm talking about what people call Episode 4. That's only one movie that I'm, like, total fanatic on. Went to the theater 30 times. I saw Star Wars before it became A New Hope. Fanatically. And, now, why did I bring that up? Because Oh, yes. It was largely based on... it borrows from every book in the world. You can see bits of Dune in there because Tatooine is obviously a place where they're farming spice and all that. But the main plot points are from a book by Edmond Hamilton. And Edmond Hamilton is Mr. Lee Brackett.
Oh, okay. And that was for the first book as well?
For the first movie.
The first movie as well.
Yeah, very much so. It's The Star Kings. is the name of that novel. And I don't know if that's easy to find or not. Of course, as far as I'm concerned, in the age of e-books, everything should be in print.
Yes. All these back titles should be.
Yeah. And there are a few places that are working on that, like Wildside Press, that buy these books in vast quantities and then put out an e-book for, like, anywhere from 99 cents to $9.99. And you get, like, 20 novels. And, yeah, that's a great deal. I like that.
Yeah, that's a fantastic thing that they're doing that more with. I guess, obviously, once the rights are gone, they can do that.
Yes, especially if they're orphaned titles.
Yeah.
And things like that. So, yeah, indeed. I don't think Lee Brackett's stuff is public domain, but I think you can get the best of Lee Brackett for a very low price.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look into it. Star Wars was really my first introduction into anything that was speculative fiction, so it holds a very dear place in my heart. I mean, I can still remember the first time I brought home one of the VHS videos from the video store. My parents had no idea what this was. And I put it on, I think I was like 11, and I was just like, I don't know what this is, but I need to know more about it and everything like it.
That's great. My next two questions were, what was the first thing that drew you in, and how old were you? And you already answered that. So I guess my next question is, did that inspire you to start writing?
No, not really. I don't have much background in writing. I was always more interested in going into academia or, you know, being a history professor, or when I was further in college, I was thinking about going to work for an international NGO. But, you know, I always loved reading. You know, I read all the time when I was younger, and I wrote some fan fiction when I was a teenager, because that was the thing we liked to do. But nothing, you know, really... past that. I mean, I didn't take any creative writing classes or anything when I was in college. It was really just, I was so history and international relations obsessed. And it was really only after I graduated and I was kind of trying to work through the recession and then work why my daughter was born, that I just kind of started with it. Basically, it was fan fiction again, but it was history and the things that I liked and writing up these worlds and adding magic and making things up. I kind of got more into writing fiction and then eventually added characters and plot and all that. But it was really more started as just this kind of thing that I played around with.
Yeah, but you're making it sound like it's simpler for you. Maybe I'm guessing you just have an affinity for it, but
I hope so.
Yeah. But you know, for many people, world building is not a simple thing. Even some of the really great writers, and I won't mention names, they have to spend a lot of time building their worlds. And I know when somebody's done a wonderful job, when there's a map with their book, which there is with The City of Brass. So did you start visually? Did you start with a map? Did you start with characters?
No, I really started more with places. I was very interested in sort of late antique and early medieval, the Islamic world, and that's sort of a broad label. But I liked learning about places like Abbasid Iraq, sort of their glory age was from the 8th through the 13th century. And I studied the Indian Ocean trade routes that would then talk about port cities on the East African coast and in Southern Arabia. And I had always an affection for Egypt, really, at any period of history. So it was just more thinking about the way those places got to be that way. And then when I started thinking about the magic of it, in Islam, we believe and, you know, I know there's this idea in the West of what, you know, genies are, which is like, you know, Aladdin and the big blue guy. But traditionally we think of them, jinn, as spirits who are created from flame and are invisible and just live alongside us for centuries. And, you know, sometimes they're bad, sometimes they're good. You know, they make decisions and everything just like us. Cool, because I love history and I was like, it would be amazing if I could just talk to these creatures who have seen thousands of years of human history and like get, you know, an actual witness account. So when I was coming up with this idea and just really trying to kind of keep my mind occupied, I was working a job I didn't really like, I thought about how the jinn would create their world and that they might mimic some of these kingdoms and places and histories that I liked learning about. So a lot of it came organically. Like I would invent a place and maybe this place would trade this certain product, but for world building and in real life, you have to go a little bit further than that. Why do they have that? And how does that affect their relationship with other people? How does it affect their cultural development? Like all these things are intertwined and organic and or don't do things. And I think I wanted to show that in my world building, to not just have, okay, this is this group and they look like this and dress like this and act like this. It was, why do they do all of those things? I mean, we all come from cultures that have reasons we do things, even if we don't think about it past the surface level. So when I was creating the world, I really wanted to do that. I wanted to stick to something and come up with the reasons that made sense.
Yeah, and it works so perfectly. Do you know what the music sounds like of this world?
A little bit. It's interesting because I sometimes would listen to, they have recreations of far older Babylonian and Mesopotamian melodies. You know, a lot of it was based on Abbasid Iraq, and unfortunately, people write so much about the musicians and the poems and everything, but there's not a lot of textual evidence of what the music would have sounded like.
Yeah, because they didn't have notation at the time.
Yeah, it was. That's one part of the history I'm not sure on, but I've read enough that they talk about it. You know, it's a little bit of a loss that we don't have what those songs would actually sound like.
Yeah, it's not Kismet.
And that I wasn't able to.
Yeah, it's not Kismet, I'll tell you that. Bubbles, bangles, and beads. But there is a wonderful album, though, called The Silk Road.
Yes, yes. I have what's his name again? Because I have a couple of his albums, and I would listen to them.
And now I'm blanking.
Yo-Yo Ma. I can't believe I just...
Exactly.
Yeah. That's a beautiful album.
It really is. And one can rightfully question the authenticity, but he certainly understands the spirit.
Exactly.
And I think that's the main thing, is to also know what we don't know and say, but this is worth imagining and taking forth. And I'm very glad that speculative fiction is finally starting to look outside of its own navel, with, you know, breakthroughs in Chinese and Chinese American literature. I should just say Asian. A few pokes here and there of African fiction, just barely peeping out. And even, in a way, if you will forgive the total pop culture segment, Thor.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, because at least Neil Gaiman's last book was Norse mythology. And it's an excellent retelling of stuff from the Upper Edda and the Poetic Edda, and, you know, those stories with the world creation. And while there's a lot of self-contradicting stuff, for example, Loki is not Thor's brother. Loki is Odin's brother.
And is that true to the mythology?
That is the mythology. The comics have it wrong.
Imagine that.
Yeah. How could that be? But on the other hand, there it's amazing how in this latest film, which is what I went to see, getting off my ouching back a couple of days ago.
I saw that a couple of days ago as well.
Okay, the depiction of what Ragnarok actually is, mm-hmm. with this fire monster who's been bottled up for thousands of years,
yeah.
who takes a sword and runs it through Valhalla, in some versions, Asgard in another. That is the ancient depiction. That is mm-hmm. that is accurate to the lore.
Oh, is it really?
It is. That's what's bizarre.
But that's kind of cool. I like that.
Yeah, so do I. Is that somehow in, I don't think in the earlier Thor films that they were thinking too much about that. But mm-hmm. then again, you have this weird, bizarre director who's partly from an Atoshthanis background in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So he grew up with a non-standard culture and brings other non-standard cultures to his way of thinking. And so he made it just, even though the movie's a comedy, he made it more authentic.
And far richer, honestly, for it. It was fantastic. I loved what he did with it.
Yeah, yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's well done. I'd read the Neil Gaiman book a little while ago, and Elisa Quitney, a friend of ours being, WBAI and the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, she'll be reading next April, by the way,
mm-hmm.
She got Neil Gaiman to write this book and helped him on it. And by the way, her father is one of the greats, all-time greats in science fiction, Robert Sheckley.
Yes, that sounds familiar.
Yeah. He's one of my favorites, but she's one of my favorites too. in her own world, in her own way, working on the Sandman comics, and she's mm-hmm. the editor of Liminal Comics, but she's a fine writer of, God help us all, best-selling romances.
There's nothing wrong with that. I like that.
No, hey,
very cool.
It buys a nice house, and she's got fanatic readers.
Uh-huh.
But she also writes science fiction, bless her.
Very cool.
Yeah. So
now I love seeing more of, we're all so much more richer for all of the more science fiction and fantasy that's coming from all parts of the world, because it's always been there. I think it's just been more an issue of the Western audiences not seeing it or not getting it translated or just rolling over it with, the way that many Western audiences can do. Having it appropriated, yeah.
Yeah, because you made a reference of the genie, and when I think of a genie, I probably go to the Douglas Fairbanks movie or to the movie starring Sabu, directed by Alexander Korda, before I think of Robin Williams as a blue genie.
Mm-hmm.
It's still not necessary. And I would say the Sabu movie, the Alexander Korda movie, is a little bit closer to the concept of a djinn.
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah,
I don't know. I know I had, it came up in an interview question recently. Somebody was asking me, they were naming a couple books that had come out about djinn, and they were like, why do you think they're popular nowadays? And I was surprised by the question almost, because I was kind of like, well, they always have been. I mean, they're a huge part of folklore and not even just folklore, active belief for a lot of people in the world. And, they're terrifying and fascinating. It's more a surprise to me that it hasn't come out sooner, because there's so much to be inspired by and to be scared by. I mean, there's some fantastic, really terrifying djinn stories from the Middle East and South Asia. I mean, when I'm with my friends and stuff, you say it as you would tell ghost stories. I mean, I talk about, before my launch party, I had this a small aside, but in the City of Brass, I had my main character, Nahri, makes up a little fact about the djinn at the point that she doesn't believe in them. She makes up that they like tamarind juice. And then later in the book, when she actually meets djinn, they are drinking tamarind juice. It was just this little thing. It was something I came up with on my own.
That's great.
Yeah, and then for the launch party, I'm like, I'm going to make some tamarind juice for my audience.
Way to go.
So, yeah, the day of, I put it on to simmer in the kitchen, and I mean, it wasn't on for more than 2 minutes. I was in the other room, and the pot just started clattering clattering like it has never clattered before. And I mean, no, it's twofold because, you know, I'm Muslim and I'm fairly Orthodox, but sometimes those things I don't really know. I won't even tell you the chill I got down my spine when this happened.
Yeah.
I went in the kitchen. It was boiling. It hadn't even been on for long. The top was shaking and I was just like, yeah, I'm not ready for this. Like, let's just, we'll turn it off. I might not drink any, give a fair warning to people who came, but you know, so it's, there's so much to be done there, you know, that you have little things like this, that it's just, it's a great thing to work from.
Yeah. It's been westernized many times, but it's in, I don't think that we have the proper handle on what it is in, you know, going back to the 1001 Nights and Scheherazade stories, which I guess are the first time they were exported to the West. But every time good stories of what they then called Oriental stories, meaning anything that was east of London is Oriental, right? Which is actually how the term came up. Every time people try that, it is successful. So you go to the 1960s and there's I Dream of Jeannie.
Oh, gosh.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like compared to its origin, it's, well, literally sacrilegious, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know that there's any part that's authentic about I Dream of Jeannie.
No, I don't think. Well,
yeah.
The design of the bottle, maybe. Just maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah. Unlikely, but if you ever the Western depiction, the Western idea of what these images, concepts, people, and folk would look like is it's its own thing.
Yeah, that's one way to say it. I mean, I always try, you know, I came to this with sort of a strange background because, you know, I am of Western origin. My great grandparents are Irish and Italian Catholics. But you know, I'm a Muslim convert, and I always tried to be, when I was working with this material, really respectful of the fact that it wasn't mine, no matter how much it inspired me. And that further on that my own country and civilization had a fairly heavy hand in horribly maligning much of the source material and the source civilizations.
And when they didn't malign, they appropriated in
exactly.
a culture so, manner. Yeah.
It's hard. I love that people are really enjoying the book and everything, but sometimes even the way certain things are described, or it'll be fronted with a painting that is just the worst in European Orientalist imagery. It makes me cringe a little because there's such a, not good history. That's not an eloquent way to put that whatsoever. But there's a lot to be said about how Western audiences view this material. And I, at least for my part, just try to kind of stick with it on my side and be like, okay, I'm writing for my community with an awareness of this. But sometimes seeing it worked around can be a little cringeworthy.
Yeah, but what's really wonderful is the way that first your agent and then the publishers accepted it and drew it in. The same thing happened to Saladin Ahmed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where just bang out of the pot. I don't know what I'm talking about. Yeah, out of the pot, out of the boiling pot of Cameron juice, his novel came out and everybody fully accepted it and went for it. And now he's working in comics.
Yeah. No, and I mean, I love his work. Actually, seeing his book come out was one of the reasons I was like, oh, maybe I can actually try to sell this. It was seeing him and G. Willow Wilson, their success. I mean, I never thought anybody was going to be interested in my book except, okay, maybe I'll self-publish and, you know, show it around to some of my fellow Muslim fantasy nerds. I didn't think a mainstream audience, not at all. And then I saw that people loved it. And that was one of the reasons I was like, oh, maybe I can do this. And both with my agent and my publisher, I fell into just fantastic hands. you know, they both really appreciated what I was trying to do and in their own way had some connection to some of the source material. My agent is Armenian, so she was familiar with some of the stuff we discussed. My publisher is Indian, and we started talking our first phone call, and she was talking about the references to Mughal India, and she picked them up, and I was like, oh, we are totally, you and I are working together now. So it was nice that I had people who I was working with who really understood what I was doing, why I was doing it, and there was never any discussion of should we cut this because it's confusing to outsiders. It was more, okay, how can we make this maybe a little clearer but keep it in? I mean, even in the book has a lot of Easter eggs that I don't think outside communities would really pick up on, but nobody said cut that. You know, I could just leave that in there, and I was really glad that I was able to do that.
I love a book that forces me to go to Wikipedia in the, in the middle of reading and saying, ooh, look at that word, look at that name. It's like, I want to know more here. And so the second time I read City of Brass, first I just read it because it was a fun adventure. Mm-hmm. I also did this with American Gods. The second time I read it, I'm looking for the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to learn from it because it's a gateway novel.
I hope so. It's the first in a trilogy, so.
Well, yes. But I mean, yeah. But it's also a gateway novel to some world building that you have done based on other people's, on a history.
Yes.
I'm trying to not use the word mythology.
Yeah.
Because one person's mythology is another person's religion.
Exactly.
So.
And that has been fun. I mean, even on that same note, I got to do. Recently, Tor has one of those, you know, five books you give recommendations on. And I wanted to do five books about, you know, the medieval Middle East. And I think I started with a list of like 20. I mean, on my website itself, I have a reading list for the period and there's probably 100 titles on there. But it was fun because I was like, okay, if people like this, you know, they might really like this tale, this collection of old sailor's tales or this that also works off it. So it's nice that, you know, like I'm fairly obsessed with this material, and I really get a kick out of giving it to other people to enjoy as well.
Yeah, that's a great thing. Tell me once again, because I'm not seeing it in front of me, what your website is. It's sashakraborty.com.
Yes.
What a concept.
Yes, I mean, it's fairly easy.
Yeah, it really is. And I'm going to have to go through that list. I hadn't seen it yet, but even now I'm looking for it.
Yeah, and that came up, you know, just because around the same time I ended up signing with my agent, I figured I would do the author public profile thing and get more on Twitter. And it was just fascinating to me. You know, I love history, and it was like an even better way to get this feed, you know, fixed for me of all these different things that I could read and share. And I love, you know, people interacting with me and being like, oh, I like this or I like this. And it's great that like it kind of feels like this, you know, community of history lovers and fantasy aficionados. So I would tweet out this material, and everyone would be like, well, what are you reading now? So I was like, okay, if this is what people want, I'm just going to make a giant list because I enjoy it and it's fun.
I'm looking at that list right now, I should say. So it's a lot of fun. I mean, anything that starts out with selections from The Art of Party Crashing in Medieval Iraq.
Oh, I love that book. That is one of my favorite sources, I think, on the planet. It was one of those things I when I first heard the title, I was like, this can't exist. But it does exist, and it's even more wonderful because the guy who wrote it is one of the most acclaimed scholars of Hadith, which is, you know, part of the Islamic sciences. And then he wrote this, and he applies some of the same ideas of, like, you know, making sure you attribute your sources and everything, except instead of religious law and example, it's like, you should do this if you're late and how to, you know, best scam for food or read poetry. It's just fantastic. You read it and it's just, it's one of those things that really brings the past alive. And I love it. It's one of my favorite books.
Right. It sounds it just from the title, if nothing else. That's interesting. You have a Van Gelder in here, Classical Arabic Literature Anthology. By Geert Jan, I guess, J-A-N, Van Gelder.
Yeah.
And
some selections.
Yeah, and of course, Gordon Van Gilder turns out to be related to a lot of people named Van Gilder, the former New York Times editor, Lawrence Van Gilder, and like that. And Gordon, of course, started the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings.
Is it just the same last name, or are they related?
Same last name. And it's not that common a last name. So when
you never know.
You never know. I will ask Gordon. because we are still in touch. And by the way, he is curating the February New York Review of Science Fiction Readings.
Oh, okay.
And he's the founder of the series.
Yes. Yeah. You'll have to ask him if he has a relative who's a scholar in classical Arabic.
Yeah. One never knows.
You never know.
Yeah. I mean, I know there are a few famous Freunds out there, but I'm not related to any of them. Carl Freund, who was the cinematographer of Metropolis and Dracula, and a lot of great films. Nope, sorry, no relationship. or if there is, it's really obscure. Too far back to make any claims.
Yeah, become friends.
Yeah. But what I was so happy, you know, A, the idea that the book was really accepted by its publishing community. I happen to know the book is from Harper Voyager, and I know the publicist there for been working with her maybe 30 years there.
Mm-hmm.
When you did your first reading that Cam put together, she was already getting in touch with me.
Yeah, no, they've been fantastic. They've really been fantastic.
Yeah, and I went over there to do an interview with a Finnish woman, wonderful writer, whose name escapes me at this moment. And that's when I first saw the cover.
When you were there, yeah.
Yes, the magnificent, amazing cover for the
It's a magnificent
Press.
Cover. I had nothing to do with it because I don't have any artistic sensibilities. But when they sent me this cover, I mean, I was literally lost my breath for a moment. It's beautiful. It's a work of art.
Yeah. Do you have a poster?
Oh, yes. I totally have a poster.
Oh, good. Good.
Yeah, no, my husband got me one for one of the events that came up in the last couple of months.
I wish I had known that because we could have used that or projected it somehow at the readings.
Oh.
Oh, well. But I was out of it. I was out of it. I was drugged up and just watching it at home and saying, no, camera left.
Oh, no.
Although Madeline did a fine job, so.
It all worked out. You were missed, but we all worked it out well.
Yeah, and Amy did a fine job as the host, Amy Goldschlager.
She did.
Where are you in the trilogy?
I actually just got notes back on book two, so I am diving back into book two, and will probably be quiet on all forms of media for a couple months. Why I do that?
Yes. You should set up a bot.
Yeah.
that just says, I'm sorry, I'm busy right now. When you get back your notes, is it from your agent, the publisher, your writer's group?
I have both my agent and my editor this round. We're trying to kind of do it a little fast. So, and I it was hard because this was the first book was literally the first book I wrote. And now this is just the second book I wrote. And it's not, you know, this thing I did on the side while the economy collapsed and it was just for fun. You know, now it's to a deadline and to actual expectations. So I've been getting a lot of feedback from people as I've been putting it together, and I'll reach out to my Brooklyn Special Fiction Writers Group, which is my fantastic writers group of which Cam is part, and I'll probably harass them all in another couple months to read and tell me what they think.
Cool. Very cool. When you started writing the first book, did you know where the third book would end?
When I started conceiving of it as not just this world-building exercise, but for an actual plot, I have to say the characters and the plot came together pretty fast for me. I was working off a lot of actual historical sort of traditions as well in terms of plot. And that arc has largely stayed the same. When I, about the same time I conceived of the characters and everything, I had an idea for how it would, the last scene would end in the third book. And as of now, I still see that happening.
That's great. That's great.
Oh, we'll see. Yeah. But it's been largely sticking to that sort of formula.
That's a question I've asked a few people, including a few prominent people, and they don't always know. They're just happy to get that first book or screenplay or whatever out, and now that they know it's going to be a trilogy, they've got to, all of a sudden, they'd spent 10 years figuring out the first book, now they've got 10 months for the second.
Yeah, I've talked to people on both spectrums as well, and I think that was one thing I was somewhat fortunate on, and I didn't even know when I was querying for an agent that, like, you know, you should tell the agent if it, say, ends in a cliffhanger and it's going to be a trilogy. I just sent off this massive book to people, and then it ended, and they were like, wait. But I did have an idea, and it's sticking to that, but at the same time, like, I like working with my editor and my agent. It's kind of fun to, these people love the book and the stories as much as I do. So it's, you know, if they suggest something, like when I was first working on the second book, before I'd even sold it, I told my agent, I was like, okay, so then the second book, you know, picks up 15 years later, and she was just like, whoa, you can't do that. So, you know, they come up with ideas and that do make changes. And it's, you know, sometimes it's interesting to follow along. It makes you think in different directions for your characters and different scenes. And I definitely don't mind, you know, thinking out of the box that I had set and being like, well, what if it did this? And what if it did this? So we'll see. I have my arc that I think it's going to follow, but you never know. Characters can be very, you know, hard to predict.
Yes. Yes, they can. And we're not going to ask any spoiler-type questions at all.
I mean, it ends in the same aliens that built the pyramids, but, you know, besides that.
There you go. That's something to look forward to.
Of course. Yes. Which I realize, since we're talking science fiction and fantasy, I should probably clarify that's not how it ends.
Right.
Because I feel like in the world we write in, that could happen.
Yeah, sometimes marketing can go too far, but it sounds like the people that you're working with are interested in, shall we say, selling it, not marketing it.
Yeah, no, they seem to let me do my thing. Yeah, but it works out well.
but they do. They're doing a nice job.
Yeah, they've been fantastic. They really have been fantastic.
I'll take a tiny bit of credit for the incredible photograph of you, because that's a friend of mine, Melissa Beckman.
You can take a lot of credit. I gave the first reading at NERSIF, and I had the photo.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the photo she took of you, I didn't realize she had done it at first. I saw that photo, and I said, wow, that was done in a studio and fabulously put together. And Melissa, who I met because she was a listener to my radio show and won a contest, a little raffle that we had on the air. And that's, by the way, about 20 years ago.
Uh-huh. And that's how it started off?
Yeah.
Yes. That's interesting.
And she's a good, close, personal friend of Barbara's and mine. And
she's fantastic. She did a whole bunch of discounted pictures for my writer's group. And that's how I ended up meeting with her. And it was at the same cafe, that it was at the Commons in Brooklyn. And
you do realize that the radio station is the third floor of that building, right?
I did not know that. It's all coming together.
Oh, yes. It's not a coincidence. That building is WBAI.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. If we were doing the show live on the air, that's where you would be right now.
I thought it was, like, further downtown. Oh, well.
No. We're in the Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue, third floor. But we do the reading series, and we have the same owner.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you know, the owner, she owns the whole building. She's, you know, a very progressive activist and stuff like that, which is how BAI ended up taking refuge in there, is a good way to put it. But I had been doing events in that building before the radio station actually moved in.
Okay.
And I guess I brought Melissa with me.
Yeah, so it's all we're all connected.
Yes, exactly, as Dirk Gently would have it. I don't know if you know that reference, but everything is connected. So
yeah, yes.
A great TV show if you ever get a chance to. Forget the British TV show. It's very weird. In this case, it's the American show.
Yeah, there's a new version out, right?
Yeah. They're in their second season.
And
there was a first TV show done for British television, and it was fairly poor. And this new version, which is done by Max Landis, who's an absolutely insane, wonderful screenwriter, son of the movie director John Landis of Animal House fame and all that. He's doing this new TV series with Elijah Wood and cast, and it's great.
I'm coming up with all these things that I have to check out after.
Good.
After we talk, instead of working on my next novel, I'm like, maybe I'll read this, maybe I'll watch this.
Yes, but as we're talking, hopefully we're getting a whole. Yeah, so with you, we're doing one to many. We are giving you many things to look at, but we're also doing one to many for the audience that many, many, many people out there need to read The City of Brass.
Oh, I hope so. I think you'll like it.
Yeah. Now, you've had short stories published.
Oh, they're little things that I first started working on when I was like, that was at the point where I was like, if I want to write a book, maybe I should learn how to write prose instead of writing for, like, grants or, you know, old historical essays. So I don't talk about those short stories anymore.
Okay. But some people find short stories harder to write than novels.
Looking back on it, I think I did and I do. I mean, I'll write – when I get, like, writer's block or whatever, sometimes I will write short stories set in my world just because I'll want to be – writing fiction and actively putting words out, but if I can't figure out, okay, how on this massive novel am I working out this jam? But I have found writing short stories just, I'm going to sit and write a short story difficult because I talk too much and write too much, and my first novel is like 580 pages long, so
yep.
Getting that down, condensing that is difficult, but I love short fiction. I mean, that's something I've been reading since I was younger, and especially in speculative fiction. I mean, there is such a rich source of fantastic short fiction out there. People who do it well amaze me.
I absolutely agree. And it's a question I often like to bring up with writers because a novel is this wonderful world in which you can walk around, stretch your elbows, do so many different things, and short stories are these little polished gems.
Yes, that's an excellent way to put it.
And there's never a word wasted.
Exactly.
In a short story. And they're both wonderful forms. But something tells me that when you're done with this trilogy, that there may be short stories from this world.
I would love that. I mean, I have a lot written that I wrote for practice or for trying to understand maybe this character's point of view who doesn't come up. So if people like them and people like them enough and my publisher likes them enough, you never know.
Yeah. So are you expecting any fanfic? Have you heard anything like that? Are people sending you pictures or anything?
I did. You know, the book just came out last week, but somebody brought an amazing drawing or painting. I'm never sure how those things are done. Of one of the main characters to it and had blown it up and put it on like nice paper. And it was so cool. I mean, you know, I've seen fan fiction for so many other fan art rather for so many other different series. So to have somebody bring me it of my characters, I mean, I was in like new writer debut giddy over the moon. It was really cool.
Yeah. I'm envious, although I'm not a writer, but I can just imagine the thrill, and you deserve it.
Oh, thanks.
Because, you know, the book is, well, an arrival in a way. It's a new voice with a theme that, you know, unless it's done really badly, and it has been done really badly, you know, in cartoons and the like, outside, or I Dream of Jeannie, however, it's arabesque fiction is, when well done, almost always finds a home in people's hearts.
We'll see. Yeah, I mean, I guess so. I don't necessarily know, like I said, I'm not an Arabic speaker, and that's not my cultural heritage, but I like to think, you know, there are just so many fantastic stories and great intrigue in this world and in this history. And even before I came back to speculative fiction, I read a lot of, well, translated, but Arabic literature, and it's just a rich source of wonderful stories.
And science.
We're
discussing fantasy, but so much science comes out of Arabic. But I was referring to what people used to refer to, I think it's a phrase that's gone out of fashion, but where something would be arabesque.
Mm-hmm.
That would just take on those cultural tones and things like that. And I think the Western world craves it, but doesn't know it.
I don't know. You know, I get variations of that question, and I want everybody to enjoy the book, but I kind of more want my community to enjoy the book, as which is terrible to say it, but like, you know, I hope people read it and enjoy it and take it for what it's worth. But I do tell people, you know, it is a story, and it's fiction, and a lot of these traditions and stuff that I'm working with have far greater pasts and sources and inspirations than I could ever do credit for in my book.
But that's so much of folk telling, so much of what is so rich in the world, which is why I brought up Thor before, because there is such a thing as Norse mythology. And, mm-hmm. and even though it's been appropriated and done in such a bizarre manner, and I was never a big Thor fan, Thor comic book fan, and yet here was fairly accurate stuff in this bizarre comedy movie. And people like it when their idiot prejudices don't get in the way.
Exactly. And I think it works too, because like, I mean, I read a lot of older stories, and I think our ancestors were better at this than we'll ever be. I mean, we have all this technology and new inspiration, and it's like, I'll go back to some of the things that come up in the Epic of Gilgamesh, and I'll be like, I would never be that creative. Like, you are better than me. Or, you know, I'll read, there's this great, Tales of the Marvelous and News of the Strange, which has a lot of these other, you know, wild stories. And I'd be like, you know, I'm a fantasy writer, but I would never think to come up with, you know, this statue is now alive and it's fighting a centaur. And it's, I mean, they are just great, and they had fantastic imaginations, and probably better than we do.
Maybe so. And I have a theory why. It's because it comes from the oral tradition.
Yeah, it might have a lot to do with it. I mean, maybe that gives ease of coming up with new things if you didn't have to sit and write and edit and all that type of thing. You know, you're open to changing and adapting a bit more.
Yeah, exactly. And when it goes from one person to the next and becomes a true folktale, when stories are being told around a fire, and even the first great version of the Arabian Nights, starring Douglas Fairbanks, opens up with a storyteller and doing it around a fire the way it has to be done. And that's why I think those bits were so rich.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because a lot of the context that a lot of these stories in particular were told in were a bit more urban. I mean, you would have in the great cities, you know, you would have either, you know, before prayers or during a certain section of the day, people gathered to hear, you know, certain revered storytellers, and, you know, they were famous. I mean, it was something you went and did, and people practiced and apprenticed to learn these type of things. And I almost think a lot of the richness is because they did come out of these very cosmopolitan, urban settings where you had people from everywhere, all sorts of different cultures and religions, and people bringing stuff in. I mean, even A Thousand and One Nights itself comes from far older sources. Its frame tale is almost certainly from India, far, you know, we're talking early India and pre-Islamic Persia. A lot of it comes from that, and it brings in tales then from sort of the far earlier centuries of the Silk Road, and it's just there's just a lot of richness when these things spread and go beyond and absorb new cultural traditions.
Yeah, and so it's fabulous stuff, and it does everything that I want out of science fiction or fantasy, which is that it takes me to a place I don't know, and welcomes me, and I welcome it.
And it holds your hand. It doesn't, you know, stab you in the back.
Right.
Although I think a good fantasy novel should occasionally do that.
Well, it should surprise you.
Yeah.
You know, a surprise in a manner that you weren't expecting, coming from a direction you weren't expecting. I don't think of that as stabbing some, you know, stabbing me in the back. I think of it as being like, whoa.
Yeah.
I did not see that coming. But that's part of the joy.
Oh, I agree.
So, in addition to the readings that we are going to play and all that, we are starting to run out of time. But let me ask you this. Do you have any fantasies, dreams, or hopes of further adaptation of... we haven't even said the name of the trilogy.
Yes. It's the Devabod trilogy.
And that you should spell for people.
Yes. It's D-A-E... V-A-B-A-D.
Okay. And so do you have any ideas or hopes? Does your agent or publisher think about what to do after the book is what we trust will be a great hit?
With the book or with further books?
First, both. In other words, do you see this book going into other media?
I don't know. I mean, I have a film agent, and we've had some interested parties. I have very strong feelings on how something like that would be adapted. I have a lot of concerns with how, especially Hollywood, tends to view the Middle East and Islam, and I would have reservations going forward with that, but you never know. So we'll see. I'm just kind of, you know, people are looking, and I'm just, that's fine, and we'll see if anything happens. In terms of additional books, I had actually started writing another one while querying, because that's what everyone tells you to do to get something to get off your mind. And I had something that hews a little closer, actually, to my old academic roots, because I wanted to study Indian Ocean trade routes in the medieval period. And this is far more of an adventure series that takes place then and really follows along on sort of the southern Arabian coast, as well as the Swahili coast, and has to do with a lot of those traders and pirates and adventure tales. So after the Devabod trilogy, that might come next.
Ooh, that sounds like fun.
Yeah. It was a very fun book to do. I mean, The City of Brass gets a little deep. This was just, you know, grandmother pirates and, you know, villains and just sword fighting and treasure. And it was a lot of fun to write.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a lot of fun to read.
Hopefully.
not hopefully. I'm expressing my reaction.
Oh, good.
Okay. You know, you can be hopeful because you wrote it. I can say...
You know what? I have found keeping my expectations on the ground is really working out for me. So they're staying there.
Yeah. It's probably a way to stay sane.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, but I don't have to do that because I'm a reader.
Well, thank you.
So I know that you have a busy day and you've been having a couple of busy weeks that I hope are a cherished part of your life. The coming out of a first novel that, by the way, we should mention, is getting rave reviews.
Yeah, it's doing pretty well. Yeah. It's doing pretty well for itself.
Yeah, the Kirkus reviews, Goodreads gives it like, I think is 4.4 out of 5.
Yes, I think it's that. Yeah, I got a couple star reviews, and I was fortunate. I mean, Amazon picked it as the best debut of November. So, like I said, keeping my expectations on the ground has been working very well.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm enjoying it. I appreciate it. I like the fact that a lot of people are enjoying it as well.
Yeah. So it's well, I'm frankly not all that surprised. I just had that feeling when I first knew about it, and when your publicist was telling me about it before even you were telling me about it. So this is thrill. So sometime we've got to try to connive to get you up to the radio station live on the air.
We will. It might take some conniving because I live in like the outer depths of Queens and have a 4-year-old, but we will have to try to connive sometime.
Piffle, I will be going to Floral Park for Thanksgiving. And I live in the most southern end of Brooklyn.
Oh, okay. Are you taking public transportation? Because have fun with that.
No. Okay. I know better. No, we will be driving. Thank you very much.
And yeah, I'm pretty close to Floral Park, and things get very tough out here with public transportation.
Yes, I know. But even where I am in Bay Ridge.
Oh, okay, you're in Bay Ridge, yeah.
Yeah, express buses are a thing of joy.
Yes. Yes.
But if we have to get you into the station or something, I can drive you. You know, we can work that out.
One day.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me, and I hope you're feeling better soon.
Yeah, you know, we didn't mention it, but this interview is like a year in the making, because the moment I met you, I asked you, when are we going to do this? And the answer was, when your book comes out. And so,
and then it was like in the blink of an eye, at least for me anyway, my book came.
Yeah. It's, a long time waiting, and then bang, there it is.
Yes.
But, I'm so pleased it's doing so well. And, any idea of the pub date of book two? And what's the title of book two?
The title of book two is The Kingdom of Copper. The publishing date, we will see. We're hoping to get it out for next year. I'm keeping my fingers crossed, and actually not keeping my fingers crossed. I'm typing very quickly with my fingers, so we'll see. I'm hopeful, but we signed and everything and did everything very quickly, so
yeah.
I'm not sure.
Okay, well, put in a reservation for if not before that, we'll be doing another radio show then.
There you go.
Okay. So thanks so much, Shan.
Thank you.
Okay, and I'll be doing, you know, better outro and intro for who you are and all that.
Okay.
Adding it to this recorded interview.
Okay.
Okay, so no have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Okay.
All right, bye.
So, okay, bye-bye. Thank you.
And once again, that was Tribekistan performing their song Baja from the album Five Star Cave. And you heard an interview with S.A. Chakraborty, whose debut novel, The City of Brass, just came out from Harper Voyager a week ago and should definitely, definitely be on your read list or gift list. Maybe you can give it to somebody. You decide. So, everybody, be good to each other. Enjoy this day of harvest celebration. Forget all that rubbish about, you know, who landed where and did what to whom. This is a traditional harvest celebration that goes back many hundreds, if not perhaps over 1,000 years. And I hope that you enjoy it. In the meantime, good morning and stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way over these airwaves shortly. Good morning.
Hi, this is Randy Credico, host of Randy Credico Live on the Fly here on WBAI Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Hey, did you know you can actually donate to WBAI via text message? That's right, for as little as $10. Just text the letters WBAI to the number 41444. Keep the vision of Lewis Hill alive. Join the WBAI $10 text team. Text WBAI to the number 41444. That's all, folks.
Happy holidays! It's the perfect time to make a thoughtful donation to WBAI and have it doubled by your employer.
Doubled?
Yeah, doubled. With employee matching gifts, some employer will match your donation to a non-profit organization. This is how you double your donation.
It's simple. Check with your HR department to make sure your employer has a workplace giving program. Just fill out the necessary forms and voila, you've given WBAI 2 holiday gifts.
Now your $500 donation becomes a $1,000 donation, and we get to make a greater radio. For details, visit wbai.org/matching.php.
Whether for the holiday season or for tax reasons, donate to Resistance Radio today. The fight continues in 2018.
On November 24th to December 10th, at the Cinema Village, Mist Harlem, and Teachers College Columbia University, celebrate Black life on the big screen with the African Diaspora International Film Festival. Discover over 60 entertaining and revealing fiction and documentary films, including 34 U.S. and New York premieres such as Mama Africa, Miriam Makeba, Sammy Davis Jr., I've Gotta Be Me, the Canadian political satire, Black Cop, and more. The African Diaspora International Film Festival from November 24th to December 10th. For tickets and schedule, go online to myadiff.org or call 212-864-1760. Enjoy your world on the big screen.
When I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
a bitch. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
99 Sinker List Alive, WBAI. 2 minutes after 3 o'clock on Misgiving Day. Terrorists and purists, blood-sucking capitalist holiday. Ha 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 ha. Burn, baby, burn, clap us.
The red, white, the blue, I'm not Captain America. Too black, too strong, causing mass hysteria. Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the
visit, cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes, cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Single list alive right here on a Thursday, the 20, of November, Misgiving Day, Indigenous Peoples Day, right here in Imperial, USA. WBAI, Pacifica Radio, at its very, very best right here. We do this flag burning thing every Thursday. Every Thursday from 3 o'clock until 5 o'clock. And if it won't burn, nice, we dip it in acid right here at 99 Cinco Lista Live.
I gotta say that she looks good.
From Montreal, Canada.
Perfect makeup.
How about some good music?
And you can't afford a car.
Yeah. 31 degrees on the outside and it's cold as hell. It's gonna go up to about 40 something. But the wind. So cold on a day like today. Misgiving Day.
gotta say, she looks nice with her brand new hairstyle. I gotta say that she looks good in that new dress she just bought. Perfect makeup, perfect nails, and you can't afford a car. Everything's good, but she forgot to put sparkles in her eyes. In her eyes.
10 minutes after 3 o'clock. Hey, 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 yeah. Maya, in a place called Germany, turned me on to a tune by Chronix, and this is what it sounds like. I'd like to dedicate this to Melody Brown and her two daughters. Rebecca and her sister too.
There's something about you, girl, and I don't think it's just your smile. I don't know how to say it now. I've been thinking for a while. The best way to say it, woman, your energy is right, yeah. Before I hold you in my arms, I wanna hold you in my heart. Before we share our love up on that bed, I wanna place this crown up on your head, woman. Girl, you're my queen, majesty. You are my queen, majesty. Don't you know you are my queen, majesty? Oh, you are my queen, majesty. Ooh. Queen of the jungle, you are the lioness. And I feel I'm a grumble, but they're always trying your best. So when the whole world a crumble, your lion is alright. Say I'm in now, but me say Cleopatra, Queen of Sheba, Nefertiti, are you are your feature? Empress, many night, beautiful creature. You summarize every queen of the East Seas out. Every night, crawler and gully creeper. I'm in a no bow, no Mona Lisa. And but me know Venus and Serena, undisputed Queen Omega. To the Ribby Bank, come to the Ribby Bank's gang girl. All good, you know, no problem, girl. Kill a body, your physique, shot them. Straight greens don't visit Agpen, and the majesty I hit a mad them. All bout a make